What if you discovered there are financial strategies out there, widely used by some of the wealthiest people on the planet? We're talking names like Buffett, Musk, Ellison strategies that seem to fly completely in the face of everything you and I have likely been taught about money. They don't just manage wealth. They interact with it using tools or concepts that feel like they belong to a different financial universe entirely.
It's a perspective shift that's, well, it's hard for most people to grasp because our lived experience with money and debt is so different, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
For the majority, debt feels like a burden, something to avoid at all costs, you know, student loans, mortgages that tie you down, credit card balances that just feel insurmountable sometimes.
Right. Debt equals bad, usually.
But for a select few, debt isn't a burden at all. It's a sophisticated tool, a lever, even described in one source we looked at as a superpower.
A superpower. Wow.
Yeah. It's used not just to buy things, but strategically to grow and preserve immense fortunes while minimizing tax. It's a whole different ballgame.
And that's exactly what we're pulling back the curtain on today. We're doing a deep dive into one of those specific high-level strategies often associated with the ultra-rich, the buy-borrow-die strategy. The name itself is quite dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's incredibly descriptive of how it works, apparently.
It is. It really cuts to the chase. It's a tax planning and wealth management framework that's both remarkably simple in its core concept and incredibly complex in its execution and implications.
Okay. So our goal in this deep dive is to really unpack this. What exactly is the buy, borrow, die strategy? How step-by-step does it actually work?
Yeah, the mechanics of it.
Why is it so incredibly effective for a specific class of people, allowing their wealth to grow in ways that seem almost unbelievable? And critically, why isn't this approach general knowledge? Why isn't it taught widely? And what does its existence and limited accessibility tell us about the different financial realities that exist? We'll be grounding all of this firmly in the stack of sources we've pulled together.
Think of this as gaining insight into a kind of parallel financial system, one that operates based on different rules and access points than most of us encounter day to day. It's about understanding another layer of how wealth functions at the highest levels.
So to do that, we've gone deep into a fascinating mix of material. We've got insights from places like Reddit forums, where people discuss financial strategies, particularly within the FIRE community, financial independence, retire early, which gives a sort of ground level perspective.
Yeah, seeing how people try to adapt or understand these concepts.
Exactly. We're also looking at analyses from financial education sites like WealthTender and White Coat Investor, more academic takes from a Chicago Policy Review piece and an NYU Law Review article.
Those get into the policy side, the tax law implications.
Right. And viewpoints on wealth disparity from inequality.org and even a YouTube channel called Proactive Thinker. It's a really great cross-section of views on this topic.
Okay, so let's begin by defining the core of this strategy. The phrase buy, borrow, die was popularized, or at least heavily associated with, Edward McCaffrey. He's a tax law professor who studies how the wealthy manage their tax obligations. And it's a concise label for a specific approach to handling appreciated assets, you know, assets that have gone up in value.
And the name really does lay out the three main acts. Like you said, first you buy. What are you buying in this context? We're not talking about groceries here.
No, definitely not. You're acquiring appreciating assets, assets with significant potential for long-term growth. Based on our sources, the most commonly cited assets are things like large portfolios of publicly traded stock.
You got big stock holdings.
Yeah, or investment real estate, often multiple properties or large commercial holdings. Sometimes other high-value assets like certain types of collectibles might fit in, but really stocks and real estate are the main focus.
And the key is appreciating.
The absolute key. These assets aren't just storehouses of value. They're expected to appreciate significantly over time. The entire strategy hinges on this underlying growth. Without substantial appreciation, the borrowing step becomes, well, problematic. It doesn't work.
Okay, so accumulate valuable stuff that's likely to get more valuable. Simple enough, at least conceptually. Then comes the step that feels counterintuitive for most people. You borrow.
Right. And this is where the strategy diverges sharply from conventional financial wisdom. Instead of selling those assets when you need cash, which, as we know, would trigger capital gains tax on all the appreciation that's happened.
Yeah, you sell stock, you pay tax on the profit, standard stuff.
Exactly. But here you don't sell, you take out loans, and crucially, you use these valuable appreciating assets as collateral for the loans.
So you're pledging the assets, not selling them.
Precisely. The funds you receive are borrowed against the value of the assets, not generated by their sale. And this is the fundamental tax deferral mechanism. Under current U.S. tax law, receiving loan proceeds is not a taxable event.
Whoa, okay. That's huge. So you get access to large amounts of cash, liquidity, without paying the tax it would be due if you had simply sold the assets to get that cash.
That's the core of it. The assets stay in your portfolio, ideally continuing to grow, continuing to appreciate.
Well, you get to use the borrowed money.
Exactly. The borrowed funds provide the liquidity you need for spending, for making large purchases, or critically, as we'll see, for reinvesting into other opportunities. Meanwhile, your original assets remain untouched, compounding in value.
Okay. Buy, borrow, and then finally you die. Which, again, happens to everyone, but in this strategy, it's the final piece of the puzzle that deals with that deferred tax liability, right?
Precisely. The goal is to hold on to these highly appreciated assets until death. Because it's at this point that the U.S. tax code offers a significant benefit for inherited assets through what's known as the stepped-up basis rule.
Stepped-up basis. Okay, we definitely need to unpack that later.
Yeah.
So just to recap the core objective, leverage the value of your appreciating assets for liquidity via borrowing, thereby deferring capital gains tax indefinitely.
Mm-hmm, pushing it down the road.
And then use the tax code at the end of your life, specifically the stepped-up basis thing, to make that deferred tax liability essentially disappear for your heirs.
That summarizes the essence beautifully. And as various sources confirm, this approach is a known strategy utilized by or associated with individuals who hold massive amounts of wealth. Think Elon Musk, Warren Buffett, Larry Ellison, people mentioned in the context of holding huge appreciated stock positions and borrowing against them.
Right. They have the sheer scale of assets where this becomes a truly powerful tool.
Okay,
let's really get into the nuts and bolts of that borrow step, because that's where the mechanics get interesting and, like you said, highlight the difference in financial tools available. How do people with immense stock portfolios or vast real estate holdings actually borrow against them on this scale? It's not like walking into your local bank for a personal loan, right?
Absolutely not. It's a different world. For large stock portfolios, a primary mechanism mentioned in the sources is something called a securities-backed line of credit, or SBLOC. You might see it spelled SBLOC.
SBLOC.
Okay. This is a flexible line of credit where your investment portfolio, your stocks, bonds, mutual funds serves as the collateral. You're borrowing against the market value of those holdings without actually selling them.
Why would a bank offer this, and why is it different from a standard loan? What makes it attractive to them?
Well, lenders like SBLOCs because the collateral of those marketable securities is highly liquid. If you default, the bank can relatively easily seize and sell your stocks to recoup their money, much easier than foreclosing on a house, for instance.
Okay. So it's lower risk for the bank?
Generally, yes. Compared to, say, a loan based purely on your income or an illiquid asset like a private business. Because the risk is lower, especially for very large, diversified portfolios, lenders, particularly the private client groups within banks that cater specifically to high net worth individuals, they're willing to offer very large lines of credit. We're talking millions, potentially much more.
And maybe better interest rates, too.
Sometimes, yes. Often at more favorable interest rates than typical consumer loans, precisely because the collateral is so strong and liquid.
And you can do something similar with real estate. Borrowing against investment properties.
Yes, absolutely. You can take out mortgages or lines of credit against the equity in your investment properties. That provides another avenue to access liquidity without selling the underlying asset. This is also a common practice among serious real estate investors. But on the scale we're discussing, it becomes part of this larger wealth management strategy, intertwined with the stock portfolio borrowing, perhaps.
Now, let's revisit that crucial distinction. Borrowing isn't a taxable event. This seems incredibly fundamental to the whole strategy. Why is it treated this way by the tax system? What's the logic?
It comes down to a core principle in tax law called realization. You're generally only taxed on income or capital gains when you realize it. That usually means when you earn the income, like getting a paycheck, or when you sell an asset for a profit.
Okay, realization means you actually got the money in a final way, not just as a loan.
Sort of. When you take out a loan, you receive cash, yes, but you also take on a corresponding liability, the obligation to repay that loan. From an accounting perspective, your net worth hasn't necessarily changed at that moment. You've simply exchanged one form of value for another. You've traded some of the equity in your assets or your borrowing capacity for cash, but you've also added a debt.
Okay. Cash in, debt out, net zero change right then.
Conceptually, yes. Since it's viewed as exchanging one form of value for another, not generating income or realizing a gain from a sale, the tax code doesn't treat receiving loan proceeds as a taxable event. And this allows someone to unlock the economic value tied up in their appreciated assets.
The gains they haven't sold yet.
Exactly. They can use that value for spending or reinvestment without paying tax on the appreciation that enabled that borrowing power in the first place.
It really is like bypassing the tax collector. On the road to accessing your wealth, you're tapping into the equity and appreciation without triggering the toll booth.
That's a pretty good analogy, actually. You gain access to funds that were effectively locked within the unrealized gains of your assets, or perhaps more accurately, your borrowing capacity against those assets.
What about the cost of this borrowing? The interest rates? The Reddit discussions mentioned things like 1% loans in the past. That sounds incredibly cheap leverage, almost free money.
Yeah. Those days of ultra-low rates were indeed a golden era for this strategy, as noted in the sources. It made the borrowing component extremely attractive. When you can borrow at, say, 1% or 2% against assets appreciating at, say, 7% or 10% or more, the math is overwhelmingly favorable.
Clearly.
However, that environment has changed significantly. Interest rates are much higher now. Our sources give more current examples. Interactive Brokers margin rates, which are sort of indicative of SBLAC costs, although not exactly the same, might be around 6.83% for a $25,000 balance as of when the source was published.
Okay, quite a jump from 1%.
Definitely. And Schwab's pledged asset line rates were cited as being in the 6% to 9% range, depending on the collateral and the size of the loan.
So quite a bit higher now.
Yes, but it's worth noting, and this is important, rates for very large loan amounts, we're talking multi-million dollar lines. And for borrowers with immense collateral, those rates are often lower than publicly advertised consumer rates.
Right.
They typically involve private negotiation with the lenders, the private banks.
Right, bespoke deals for the ultra wealthy.
Essentially, yes. But still, the general trend is that borrowing costs are higher now, which naturally impacts the strategy's effectiveness.
Okay, so the cost of borrowing is higher now. Does the interest cost start to eat away at the benefits? Does it make the strategy less appealing?
It absolutely can, especially if the interest rate gets too close to or even exceeds the rate of your asset appreciation after taxes. That's a key calculation.
Makes sense.
However, there are factors that can mitigate this. Firstly, the interest paid on these loans can often be tax deductible.
Oh, okay. So you get a tax break on the interest cost itself.
Potentially. Our sources mention this is typically the case if the borrowed funds are used for investment purposes. So if you borrow the money and use it to buy more stocks, or invest in a business, or maybe even for certain home improvements that increase the property's value.
You can write off the interest.
Often, yes. Using the funds purely for personal consumption, like buying a yacht, might not qualify the interest for deduction. But for wealthy individuals using this strategy strategically, the borrowed funds are frequently reinvested or used in ways that do qualify. That deduction lowers the effective cost of the loan.
Okay, that helps. And how do they manage paying this interest or potentially making principal payments when the whole point is to avoid selling their main assets? Where does the cash flow come from?
Good question. The sources outline several methods. They might use other sources of taxable income they already have, maybe from a business or salary if they still have one.
Right.
Importantly, they can use income generated by the assets themselves.
Like dividends from the stocks.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Qualified dividends from stocks are a key one because those are taxed at favorable capital gains rates, currently 0%, 15%, or 20%, depending on your overall income, which is usually much lower than ordinary income tax rates. So that's a tax-efficient way to get cash flow to service the debt.
Okay. What else?
They might also use returns from investments specifically chosen for tax efficiency. Think interest from certain federal bonds, like the SGOV ETF mentioned in one source, where the interest is often exempt from state income tax. Or maybe cash sweeps returns from their brokerage accounts, although those are typically taxed as ordinary income.
So they have various streams, some more tax advantaged than others, to handle the loan payments without touching the core appreciating assets.
That's the idea. They manage the cash flow to service the debt while letting the main engine, the appreciating assets, keep running.
This brings us to a critical piece of why this debt doesn't necessarily bury them, even when they're borrowing millions or billions. The debt can grow, sure, but the assets are ideally growing faster. Is that the core math?
That's absolutely the core math. This is where the power of compounding appreciation comes in, especially when you're dealing with significant asset bases. The amount borrowed is typically kept well below the total value of the collateral.
Right. The banks wouldn't lend 100% anyway.
No way. Lenders have loan-to-value, or LTV, ratios they work with. For SBLOCs on stocks, it might often be 50% or less, meaning if you have $10 million in stock, they might lend you up to $5 million against it. But borrowers using the strategy wisely will often keep it even lower than the maximum allowed.
Why lower? For safety.
Exactly. Maybe aiming for below 30% of the account value, as one Reddit user suggested. Yeah. This provides a crucial buffer against market drops and helps avoid those dreaded margin calls we need to talk about.
Okay, so let's run a quick example. If you borrow, say, $30 million against a $100 million portfolio,
okay,
and the portfolio grows by 10% in the year, that's $10 million in appreciation.
Right.
Meanwhile, your interest cost is, let's say, 7% on the $30 million loan. That's $2.1 million in interest for the year.
Mm.
So your assets grew by $10 million. Your debt grew by $2.1 million if you just paid interest or let it accrue. Your net worth assets minus debt has still grown significantly, right? By $7.9 million in that simplified case.
That's the fundamental math that makes the strategy work over the long term. As long as the after-tax appreciation rate of the assets exceeds the after-tax interest rate on the debt, your net value continues to climb. The debt increases, yes, but your underlying equity, the difference between the asset value and the loan balance, grows even faster.
So you get cash flow now without stopping the engine of compounding wealth.
That's precisely it.
Okay. That detailed breakdown of the borrow step really shows how debt functions differently at this level. It's a tool, not just a burden. Now let's move to the DAI step and this incredible tax advantage provided by the stepped-up basis rule. You said it makes the deferred tax disappear. How?
Yeah, this is the mechanism that allows the decades of deferred capital gains tax to effectively vanish upon death.
Hmm.
Under current U.S. tax law specifically, Section 1014 of the Internal Revenue Code is the relevant part. When you inherit assets like stocks or real estate, the cost basis of those assets is reset. It's stepped up.
Stepped up to what?
To their fair market value on the date of the original owner's death.
Let's use that example again to make it crystal clear. If someone bought shares years ago for, say, $10,000.
Okay, a low basis.
And at the time of their death, maybe decades later, those same shares are worth $10 million. A huge gain. $9,990,000.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to the tax on that massive gain when the heir inherits it?
Under stepped-up basis, the heir's new cost basis for those shares becomes $10 million, the market value at the time of death, not the original $10,000.
Okay, their basis is now $10 million. So what happens if they sell?
If the heir then turns around and sells those shares immediately for $10 million, their capital gain is calculated as the sale price, $10 million, minus their new stepped-up basis, $10 million, which equals
zero.
Zero.
Zero gain means zero capital gains tax owed on that sale by the heir.
Precisely. That nearly $10 million of appreciation that occurred during the original owner's lifetime. The capital gains tax liability on that amount is completely wiped out. It is never taxed at the federal level as capital gains. The heir can sell the assets, potentially use the proceeds to pay off any outstanding loans that were part of the borrow strategy, like the SBLOCs we discussed.
Right, pay off the debt.
And the remaining wealth transfers to them without the government ever collecting capital gains tax on the growth that funded the original owner's borrowing or simply compounded over all those years.
Wow. So you buy, let it grow, borrow against it for liquidity and reinvestment without selling and triggering tax, and then death, through this stepped-up basis rule, makes the accumulated capital gains tax liability disappear entirely for the next generation. That is a powerful intergenerational wealth transfer mechanism.
It absolutely is. It provides a massive tax advantage for holding assets until death rather than selling them during your lifetime. And it's why, as one Reddit commenter mentioned in the sources, proposals sometimes arise to get rid of rebasing portfolios on death. It highlights that this is a known and sometimes controversial feature of the tax code with huge implications for wealth transfer.
Okay, let's synthesize the power and benefits of this. Beyond the tax avoidance, which is obviously huge, What makes this strategy so incredibly effective for wealth building over the long term, according to our sources?
Well, the primary power, as we've touched on, is that ability to access significant economic value from your wealth, potentially millions or even billions, without triggering the capital gains tax that would immediately reduce the pool of assets available to continue growing.
Right, the tax drag.
Exactly. Every time you sell an asset to fund expenses or make new investments, a portion of the proceeds goes straight to taxes. That reduces the base that's left to generate future growth.
Hmm.
With buy, borrow, die, you avoid that tax drag on your core assets for your entire lifetime.
And the compounding effect of that tax deferral must be enormous over decades.
It's staggering. The Wealthtender source provides some really compelling simulations that illustrate this dramatically. They show that starting with, say, a $10 million taxable portfolio and assuming a steady rate of appreciation, the net worth accumulated over several decades using the BBD approach is vastly higher than if you had to sell assets periodically to generate cash for living expenses or other needs.
Can you give us a couple of those numbers? Just how big is the difference?
Sure. In one simulation they ran, starting with that $10 million and assuming a pretty robust 15% annual return over 35 years, which is high, but illustrates the point.
Yeah, for illustration.
The BBD method results in a net worth soaring to approximately $450
million. $450
million
from $10 million.
Wow, yeah. In contrast, a strategy requiring periodic selling to cover the same expenses leads to a net worth of around $260 million over that same 35-year period.
That gets a difference of nearly $200 million. Just from avoiding the tax drag by borrowing instead of selling.
Exactly. The difference is massive. And even with a more conservative, perhaps more realistic 7% annual return over 35 years, the simulation showed the BBD strategy still resulted in a net worth roughly 5 times higher than the strategy involving periodic sales.
5 times higher.
Yes. The power of uninterrupted compounding, free from the drag of capital gains tax, is just immense over long time horizons.
So the strategy isn't just about avoiding tax today. It's fundamentally about accelerating the growth of your total wealth by keeping the absolute maximum amount invested and compounding for as long as possible.
Precisely. And the borrowed funds, it's important to remember, aren't just used for, you know, buying bigger yachts, though they certainly can be. They provide the liquidity for significant investments in ventures.
Right. Like reinvesting.
The sources point to examples like Larry Ellison reportedly pledging Oracle shares to fund other business interests, or Elon Musk using Tesla shares as collateral for potential deals, like the Twitter acquisition initially. This is debt used not as a burden for consumption, but as powerful leverage to acquire more assets or fund more wealth-generating opportunities.
It completely reframes that common notion of debt being inherently bad, which the Proactive Thinker source emphasized as a key difference in financial mindset.
Exactly. For those with significant assets, strategic debt becomes a tool, maybe even that superpower, for accelerating wealth creation.
It truly operates as a kind of financial superpower for those who can access it, allowing them to deploy vast amounts of capital without liquidating their core holdings and triggering tax. But like any superpower, it comes with significant risks, right? What are the major potential downsides or ways this strategy can go wrong? It can't be all upside.
No, definitely not. The risks are substantial and potentially catastrophic. The most significant risk, and the one that can lead to really dramatic losses, is a sharp market downturn, a crash.
Because the collateral value drops.
Exactly. The strategy relies on the value of your collateral assets, your stocks, your real estate remaining stable, or ideally increasing. If the market crashes, the value of those assets can plummet.
And that triggers the dreaded margin call. What exactly happens when that occurs in this context?
Okay, so a margin call happens when the value of your collateral falls below the level required by the lender. They have these maintenance margin requirements, often based on that loan-to-value ratio we talked about. If your assets drop enough that your loan amount is too high relative to the new lower value of your collateral,
the bank gets nervous.
Very nervous. The lender then requires you to immediately, and they mean immediately, add more cash or pledge additional acceptable assets to the account to restore the required LTV ratio, or alternatively, to pay down the loan balance.
And if you don't have the readily available cash or other unpledged assets to satisfy that margin call, what then?
Then the lender exercises their right to sell your collateral assets, and they don't ask politely.
They just sell your stocks.
They just sell. This is often done rapidly and potentially at the absolute worst possible time when asset prices are already severely depressed during a market crash. Being forced to liquidate a large portfolio at distressed prices can wipe out a significant portion of your wealth incredibly quickly. You could end up losing far more than you initially borrowed, potentially ending up with little or nothing left after the loans are repaid from the forced sale.
Wow. That's terrifying.
It is. The collapse of Bill Huang's Archegos Capital Management a few years back, which resulted in something like a $20 billion loss for the banks involved, is often cited as a stark, albeit complex, example of the extreme danger of overleveraging assets that can drop sharply in value. It shows how quickly things can unravel.
So while the strategy offers incredible upside potential through leverage and tax deferral, it also exposes you to massive downside risk if you're caught under-collateralized in a falling market. It requires not just assets, but a significant cushion, right?
Exactly, a huge cushion. As one Reddit user wisely pointed out in the sources, to effectively use this strategy and manage the downside risks, you need a very large nest egg and the ability to adjust your spending downward if things go wrong. You need substantial reserves, perhaps in safer assets, to meet potential margin calls, and you need flexibility in your cash needs so you're not forced to borrow right up to the limit.
Okay, market risk is huge. What about interest rate risk? We talked about rates being higher now. Does that pose a separate risk?
Absolutely. It's a major factor now. While those ultra low rates we mentioned were a major tailwind for this strategy, rising interest rates can become a significant headwind.
How so?
Well, if the interest rate on your borrowed funds climbs higher than the net of tax rate of appreciation on your assets, then your debt burden starts growing faster than the value of your collateral is growing.
So your net worth starts shrinking.
Exactly. Your net worth, assets minus debt, begins to erode. At that point, the ongoing cost of borrowing might actually exceed the long-term benefit you're getting from tax deferral compared to just biting the bullet and paying the capital gains tax.
Right. The math flips against you.
Precisely. A Reddit comment highlighted this perfectly, noting that for many people looking at this now, current interest costs could easily negate any potential tax savings. The calculation becomes much less clear-cut than it was when rates were near zero.
So the strategy is most powerful and less risky in low interest rate environments where asset appreciation comfortably outpaces borrowing costs.
Correct. It becomes less compelling and certainly more precarious when borrowing costs are high relative to anticipated asset growth.
The margin for error shrinks.
And this leads us to perhaps the most fundamental limitation, the one that really separates this from mainstream advice. The strategy requires substantial assets just to get started. You can't just decide to do this with your first $10,000 saved. No, not even close. This is the primary reason. This isn't a general financial strategy taught to everyone in, say, Personal Finance 101. The sources are very clear on this. It works best, really only works effectively, when your assets are so large, the small percentage you borrow is all you need to finance your lifestyle.
So scale matters a lot.
Immensely. Lenders who offer these types of loans, the SBLOCs, the large portfolio loans, especially at those potentially favorable negotiated terms, they require significant collateral. We're talking about portfolios or real estate holdings worth millions, sometimes tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars.
It's not something you can access with your first $100,000 in savings, or even maybe the first million for some of these applications.
Generally, not for the kind of scale and terms that make the strategy really powerful. Minimum collateral requirements for products like Schwab's Pledged Asset Line were mentioned as potentially needing several hundred thousand in collateral just to get the minimum $100,000 loan value. And discussions among FIRE communities on Reddit, where people are often trying to figure out if they can use a version of this, suggest numbers upwards of $600K, $700K in portfolio size as maybe a bare minimum for certain niche uses, or even needing $3 million plus in household income and portfolio size for it to be realistically viable for anything beyond a very short-term bridge loan.
Right. One user apparently noted $400 wasn't enough for even a five-year bridge loan.
Exactly. This access barrier is significant. These lending products are typically offered by the private banking or wealth management arms of financial institutions. These divisions deal exclusively with high net worth and ultra high net worth clients. It's a different service level with different products.
So it's not just about having assets. It's about having enough assets to qualify for this specific class of lending products and the associated advice.
Exactly. And it's also complex, as we've seen. Managing the LTV ratios, understanding the specific tax implications depending on how the borrowed funds are used, projecting future returns and interest rates, it requires a high level of financial sophistication.
It's not DIY for most people.
Definitely not. It often necessitates working with specialized wealth advisors who understand these intricate strategies and the associated risks. And access to that kind of advice is itself often tied to having a certain level of asset. So there's a knowledge barrier and an advice barrier here too.
You mentioned briefly another variant involving cash value life insurance in the risks section. How does that fit into this borrowing picture? Is it common?
It's another angle mentioned in one of the Reddit sources, though often considered more expensive or less efficient for purely liquidity purposes compared to SBLOCs for many people. But yes, certain types of permanent life insurance policies like whole life or universal life build up a cash value over time. That cash value grows tax deferred.
Okay, like a savings component inside the insurance?
Sort of. And policyholders can then borrow against this cash value using the policy itself as collateral. The interest paid on these policy loans might just be added to the loan balance rather than paid out of pocket. Upon the policyholder's death, the death benefit, which is typically received income tax-free by the beneficiaries, can be used first to pay off the outstanding loan balance, including the accrued interest. Any remaining death benefit then goes to the heirs.
So it's a similar principle. Access value without immediate tax, let appreciation happen in the cash value, and then use a tax-advantaged event, the death benefit, to settle the debt.
Yes, the structure is analogous in that way. However, the sources generally note that the high premiums associated with these policies and the potentially modest growth rate of the cash value compared to direct market investments often make this a less efficient strategy solely for accessing liquidity compared to borrowing against stocks or real estate.
So why do it then?
It might make sense if there are other primary reasons for having the large life insurance policy in the first place, like complex estate planning needs, providing liquidity to pay estate taxes, business succession planning, or maybe for asset protection in some jurisdictions. For certain niches, like some business owners or those with significant rental properties needing liquidity buffers, it can be an effective tool, but probably not the first choice just for borrowing power for most.
Okay, got it. So we've broken down the strategy, its power, its significant risks, and its limitations, particularly that huge barrier of needing massive assets. This leads naturally to the question we posed at the start. Why isn't this general knowledge? Why isn't buy, borrow, die something taught in a standard personal finance class? It seems so fundamental to how huge wealth operates.
Yeah, it's a great question. Fundamentally, as the sources collectively highlight, it comes down to accessibility and relevance for the average person. The most obvious barrier, as we just hammered home, is the sheer scale of assets required.
Right. Most people just don't have millions in stocks.
Exactly. The vast majority of the population simply doesn't have the multi-million dollar portfolios or extensive real estate holdings needed to qualify for the types of loans the SBLCs, the large private banking lines that make this strategy feasible and relatively low risk, you know, aside from the inherent market volatility risk.
So it's simply not applicable to most people's financial reality. You can't teach something that people can't use.
Pretty much. And the financial products themselves, as we discussed, these large-scale, often bespoke, collateralized lines of credit, they are not standard consumer products. They're part of a different tier of financial services catering to significant wealth. You don't see ads for SBLOCs during the Super Bowl.
Huh. No, you don't. And then there's the cultural or educational aspect you touched on earlier, the perception of debt.
Yes. This is a crucial point raised by sources like Proactive Thinker. For most people, the primary experience of debt is, frankly, negative or at least burdensome. It's student loans that feel like a lifelong chain. Mortgages that are necessary to own a home but limit financial flexibility for decades, or high-interest credit card debt often used for consumption.
Right. Debts that have to be paid back out of future work income, essentially.
Exactly. These common forms of debt are typically not taken out against appreciating assets that are expected to grow significantly faster than the interest rate. They are often perceived, rightly in many cases, as burdens that reduce net worth and require repayment from future earnings, often taxed earnings.
So our collective experience, the narrative we absorb, teaches us that debt is bad. Avoid it. Pay it down quickly.
Precisely. And the general financial education out there is rightly focused, for most people, on managing and paying off that burdensome debt, saving for retirement in tax-advantaged accounts like 401ks or IRAs, maybe buying a primary home. The concept of viewing debt as strategic leverage, as a tool to amplify wealth rather than a burden resulting from consumption, requires a totally different financial framework.
And different tools, and a different starting point.
Absolutely. A different set of tools accessible only with large assets, and a very different starting point in terms of existing wealth. This huge difference in understanding, experience, and access contributes significantly to why the BBD strategy remains primarily in the domain of the wealthy and isn't really part of mainstream financial literacy. It wouldn't make sense for most people.
It also sounds like the complexity we discussed and the need for sophisticated advice act as further barriers.
They absolutely do. Successfully implementing and managing a buy, borrow, die strategy over decades requires a deep understanding of tax law nuances, careful risk management, particularly around those LTV ratios and potential margin calls, and familiarity with specific lending products and negotiation.
It's not a simple formula you can just plug numbers into from a blog post.
Definitely not. It really requires working with experienced advisors, tax attorneys, wealth managers who specialize in these high net worth strategies. And accessing that kind of specialized advice, again, often comes with its own high asset minimum. So it's another layer of inaccessibility for the average person.
Okay. So this strategy, while perfectly legal, really highlights a very different financial landscape available at the top. Let's turn now to the broader implications of strategies like this based on what our sources were discussing. What does the existence and, frankly, the effectiveness of buy, borrow, die tell us about wealth concentration and the way our tax system functions?
Well, as the inequality.org source points out quite directly, strategies like BBD and even just the simpler strategy of holding appreciating assets for very long periods without selling, buy, hold for decades, sell, are central to understanding how the wealthiest individuals often pay very low effective tax rates on the immense growth of their wealth, especially when compared to the tax rates on income earned from labor.
How does that work out to a low effective rate? I mean, eventually, if they sell, they pay capital gains tax, or if they die, maybe estate tax.
Okay, let's break that down. First, estate tax currently only applies to estates above a very high exemption level, over $13 million per person as of 2024. So it doesn't affect most people, even many who are quite wealthy. The bigger factor for wealth growth is the capital gains tax. The source explains that the tax is only owed when the asset is sold, when the gain is realized.
Right, the realization principle again.
If you hold an asset for decades, the tax liability on all the appreciation that happens year after year is deferred for that entire time. The benefit of letting that wealth compound completely untaxed for potentially 30, 40, 50 years is enormous. It far outweighs the eventual capital gains tax payment, even at the current top federal rate of 23.8%. 20% plus the 3.8% net investment income tax.
So the timing of the tax makes a huge difference.
A huge difference. The inequality.org piece cited an example showing how the effective annual tax rate on the wealth growth for a long-held asset can work out to be incredibly low when you average it over the holding period. Maybe something like 3.75% per year effectively, compared to the much higher marginal income tax rates paid annually by working individuals on their salaries, or even compared to that 23.8% statutory capital gains rate if it were applied annually to the unrealized gains, which it isn't.
And with buy, borrow, die, using the stepped-up basis at death, that eventual capital gains tax payment might never happen at all.
Exactly. That's the ultimate benefit of BBD. The wealth grows exponentially, potentially funding lifestyle or reinvestment through borrowing, and then the tax collected on that growth can be minimal or even zero, especially when compared to income from wages or salaries, which gets taxed year in, year out.
So the system, as it currently stands, effectively taxes wealth accumulation from asset appreciation very differently and often much, much less than income earned from work.
Yeah.
Especially for those who have the scale and sophistication to utilize strategies like BBD.
That's a key takeaway from several of the sources, yes. The combination of the realization principle for capital gains, the stepped-up basis rule at death, and the ability to borrow against unrealized gains creates a financial environment where large pools of capital can grow and be accessed with significantly less tax friction than income generated from labor.
And the borrowed funds themselves, just to reiterate, are used for substantial purposes by those employing this, not just pocket change.
Oh, absolutely. As noted earlier, the liquidity provided by BBD isn't just for, you know, covering the grocery bill. For the wealthy employing this strategy effectively, these borrowed funds can support very significant lifestyle costs. They enable major purchases like multi-million dollar homes, artwork, yachts, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And crucially, they are often reinvested into other businesses or assets. This creates a powerful feedback loop that can accelerate further wealth accumulation, all funded initially by borrowing against unrealized gains from previous investments.
This dynamic, where wealth grows rapidly with minimal tax consequences through specific strategies accessible only to those with significant existing assets, naturally fuels policy debate, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. The existence and the clear effectiveness of strategies like buy, borrow, die are really central to ongoing discussions about tax fairness, economic inequality, and how to potentially address wealth concentration. Policymakers, economists, tax scholars, they've proposed various solutions aimed at taxing the wealthy more effectively, often by targeting the specific mechanisms that allow for this kind of massive tax deferral and ultimate avoidance.
What are some of those proposed solutions mentioned in the NYU Law Review source? What are people talking about doing?
The article discusses several prominent proposals that circulate in tax policy debates. One is implementing a direct wealth tax, which would tax an individual's total net worth annually, usually above a certain high threshold.
Taxing the stock of wealth, not just the flow of income or gains.
Exactly. Another idea is a mark-to-market income tax system for assets. This would mean taxing the annual increase in value of assets like stocks each year, regardless of whether they are sold or not, so taxing unrealized gains annually.
That would directly counteract the deferral aspect.
It would. And then, perhaps most directly relevant to the DIE part of BBD, is the recurring proposal to repeal the stepped-up basis rule at death.
So instead of the basis resetting to market value at death,
the heir would inherit the deceased's original lower cost basis. The deferred capital gains tax liability would carry over to the heir and would eventually be taxed when they sell the asset. Or perhaps tax would be due at the time of death or gifting, treating it as a final realization event for the original owner.
Okay, those sound like major potential changes. But the source also notes they face challenges.
Yes, significant pragmatic and political challenges. There are ongoing debates about the constitutionality of a direct wealth tax in the U.S. framework. All of these proposals face enormous political hurdles to actually get enacted into law. And there are concerns about public support, implementation complexity, potential economic impacts. It's very difficult territory.
So the NYU Law Review article focuses on a potentially more targeted approach, one aimed specifically at the borrow part.
Yes, that's the specific proposal they analyze in detail. It's called Realization at Borrowing. The core idea is to treat the act of borrowing against significantly appreciated assets as a taxable event, similar to a sale, at least for the portion of the loan proceeds that effectively represent cashing out unrealized appreciation.
Okay, walk me through that. If your stock portfolio had, say, $50 million in unrealized gains from a low basis, and you borrowed $10 million against it using an SBLOC,
under this proposal, you might owe capital gains tax on that $10 million as if you had effectively realized that much of your gain by borrowing against it and getting the cash.
So borrowing itself would trigger the tax that BBD currently avoids at that step.
That's the core idea. The argument is that by borrowing, you have accessed the economic value of that appreciation, you've converted it into usable funds, and therefore, that access itself should trigger a tax liability just like a sale would. The source presents this realization at borrowing concept as a potential incremental second-best solution, meaning perhaps less comprehensive than a full wealth tax or a complete mark-to-market system, but potentially more politically palatable and constitutionally sound, while still directly curbing a key aspect of the buy-borrow-die strategy's tax deferral power.
Interesting. But even that has potential drawbacks or ways around it.
The source acknowledges that, yes, for instance, such a rule could potentially incentivize wealthy individuals to shift towards using unsecured debt if possible, which presumably wouldn't trigger the tax since it's not directly collateralized by the appreciated assets.
Ah, loophole.
Potentially, although the article also notes that non-tax factors, like the typically much higher interest rates on unsecured debt and the general unwillingness of lenders to offer huge unsecured loans, would likely limit the extent of this kind of shift. It just highlights the complexity policymakers face. You plug one hole, another might appear. Designing effective tax policies for the very complex financial arrangements of high net worth individuals is really challenging.
It's clear that there are very different philosophies at play when it comes to wealth, taxes, and legacy. The Reddit sources briefly touched on the die with zero concept. How does that contrast with the whole ethos of buy, borrow, die?
Yeah, that's an interesting contrast. The die with zero philosophy, which you sometimes hear discussed in buyer circles or personal finance more broadly, is essentially about strategically spending down your assets and wealth during your lifetime. The goal is to maximize your enjoyment and utility from your money while you're alive, aiming to leave little or nothing behind at death.
Use it or lose it, kind of?
Sort of, yeah. This is almost the polar opposite of the buy, borrow, die strategy. BBD is fundamentally designed to preserve and grow wealth intergenerationally while providing liquidity to the current owner through borrowing and culminating in a highly tax-advantaged transfer of that preserved wealth at death via stepped-up basis.
So one focuses on maximizing personal utility during life, the other on maximizing wealth transfer to heirs with minimal tax friction.
Exactly. They represent fundamentally different goals and philosophies for what one should do with accumulated wealth.
Okay, that was quite a journey through a financial strategy that feels worlds away from typical personal finance advice. To wrap this deep dive up, let's try to summarize the key takeaways. The buy, borrow, die strategy is it's a completely legal, albeit complex and definitely high stakes, method used primarily by those with very substantial assets.
It leverages the power of long-term asset appreciation and combines it with specific features of the U.S. tax code, particularly the crucial facts that borrowing money isn't taxed as income or gain, and the stepped-up basis rule at death eliminates capital gains tax liability for heirs on assets held until death.
Right. And together, this allows individuals to access the economic value of their growing wealth through borrowing, letting that wealth continue compounding largely untouched while deferring and potentially ultimately eliminating the income tax liability on that growth.
Precisely. And its accessibility is severely limited. It's not just by the massive asset requirements needed to even get the right kind of loans, but also by the need for those specialized financial products, a different cultural understanding and tolerance of debt, viewing it as leverage rather than purely a burden and the requirement for sophisticated financial planning and advice.
It really operates in a financial landscape, a parallel system almost, that's largely distinct from what most people navigate day to day.
Yeah. And understanding strategies like this isn't merely academic or just about, how the rich get richer. It reveals how different rules, different tools, and different access points within the financial system can profoundly impact wealth accumulation depending on your starting point and your level of wealth. It really highlights how elements like tax codes can create very different outcomes and incentives for different groups of people.
It shows that the path to building and preserving wealth isn't a single uniform road. There are different systems at play, different rules for different players almost.
Indeed. And perhaps on a smaller scale, even just seeing debt used intentionally as a powerful tool for leverage rather than solely as a burden resulting from consumption offers a different perspective on personal finance itself, regardless of the scale you're operating at.
Yeah, thinking about leverage versus burden is interesting for anyone. Okay, so here's the provocative thought to leave you with after this deep dive. Considering how incredibly effective strategies like buy, borrow, die are for allowing significant wealth to grow and be accessed with minimal tax friction compared to how income from labor is taxed year after year, what does this reveal about the fundamental design of our financial and tax systems?
And following on that, what might be the long-term implications for economic inequality if these powerful wealth-building and preservation tools remain primarily accessible only to those who are already at the very top of the wealth distribution?
Also, reflecting on that difference between debt as a burden and debt as potential leverage, how does understanding that distinction influence your own financial thinking, even within the context of your own personal scale and goals?
Lots to chew on there.
Definitely something to really think about. That was our deep dive into buy, borrow, die.